Okay.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks for tuning in. First, a true story about downfall and redemption in a place unlike any other.
Next, upcoming weather predictions. Find out what's in store for the summer.
Why is it that our eyes can be so insightful about our health?
Plus, It Takes a Village, a network that helps seniors to age in place.
And Train Travel Adventure. Leprosy, now known as Hansen's disease, is one of the most ancient afflictions known to mankind, conjuring up images of biblical suffering, sin, and shame. It's also a disease Neil White never in his wildest dreams imagined he would witness up close and personal.
In his memoir, In the Sanctuary of Outcasts, you'll find the incredible story of downfall and ultimate redemption in an unlikely place, the last leper colony in the United States. Neil White joins us on the phone from Oxford, Mississippi. Welcome to the program, Neil.
Thank you, Barb and Kathy. Appreciate it.
Neil, let's go back 20 years ago when you were 32 or so, and you were married with a couple of kids. You were editor of the local Oxford Times, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you were publisher of glossy magazines. I mean, you really had quite the media career, and you were living quite a lavish lifestyle.
I was.
What happened?
I couldn't maintain it. What happened was I tried to expand. My problem was not the business I was in. It was the man running the business. I was so ambitious and so prideful and so determined to build this huge magazine company, regardless of the facts, that I ran out of money and basically stumbled upon this technique that it's a crime you can't commit anymore with electronic clearance, but it's called kiting checks. And I would kite checks off and on to create a temporary false balance to sort of fund the expansion of the business until real money came in. And it's a crime. And the FDIC came in and did an audit in one of the banks, and my house of cards fell.
And then you were eventually convicted, right, of bank fraud?
Well, it's interesting. I was never arrested. I was never handcuffed. I filed what they call an information, where you just take responsibility for what you did, and I signed that, and I only appeared in court one time to plead guilty and be sentenced.
Okay, and how long were you sentenced?
I was sentenced to 18 months in a minimum security prison.
Okay.
One that I'd never heard of.
Well, Neil, not only were you going to prison and really giving up your freedom, but you left behind many angry investors. So did you borrow a lot of money from family and friends to support the business?
Absolutely. Ooh. Absolutely.
Well, and also you had your wife and family. How did your wife react to your crimes?
Well, she didn't know anything about it. And so understandably, she was blindsided. She felt betrayed and like I'd not been honest and loyal. And all those things were true. My children were 6 and 3. They were a bit young to understand the full impact of what was going on. But Linda, my wife at the time, was just, you know, not only upset, but when I went to prison, she was left to face these people. I think she was doing harder time than I was. She was, you know, going to the church and not being able to go to the old country clubs and seeing people around. It was just terrible for her.
So you were sentenced to prison and you reported to a place in Carville, Louisiana to begin your sentence.
Right.
When did you realize, Neil, that it was no ordinary prison and really not a prison at all?
This was pre-internet. This was 1992. So I thought I was going to a typical minimum security prison. I've showed up with a leather bag with racquetball rackets and tennis shoes and, you know, gym shoes and books like I was going to camp. And as I was waiting for a guard to collect me, I saw a gentleman walking down the hallway, and when he got to the window closest to me, he waved to me and he didn't have any fingers. And that was the first time I knew something was awry.
Ooh. Well, were you concerned at all about your own well-being and safety?
Well, I had heard that these minimum security prisons were not dangerous to you physically. If you got into a real fight, the inmates broke it up because you would end up going to a real prison. So I thought I would be safe. But the guard came to collect me and strip searched me and went through my belongings and left me with 2 books and some shorts and a shirt and pushed me out into the inmate courtyard. And what I saw was a scene like I just could never imagine. There were 15 men over 500 pounds, the most obese inmates in the federal system, men amputated so far up their torso that they had to be in buckets so they wouldn't fall out of their wheelchair, other inmates sunbathing on a shuffleboard court, And then an inmate driving a four-wheeler rolled up in front of me and howled like a dog. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, they got lepers here." And I said, I just heard." And he said, "And you're a convict, right?" And I said, "Well, I guess." And so he said, "Well, that makes you a leprechaun." And then he howled like a dog and drove off again.
Well, Neil, I had
been in prison maybe 40 seconds at the
time.
Oh, my goodness. So tell us what Carville is. Is it a prison? Is it a leper colony? What is it?
Well, at that time, let me put it this way. From 1896 until 1992, it was a leprosarium where the victims of leprosy went. It was originally the Louisiana Leper Home, which the governor of Louisiana wanted everybody to deny its existence because he thought it would hurt tourism and commerce. And then it became the National Leprosarium in 1921. So it was a leper colony for, you know, almost a century. And by the early 1990s, all the leprosy patients but 130 had died. These were the last Americans in prison for a disease. And a fiscally responsible bureaucrat said, "Let's don't waste taxpayer money on a new prison. Let's put nonviolent offenders and inmates who need medical treatment in all these empty rooms." And I don't think they really ever stepped back and said, "Gosh, is this such a great idea?" But it was a convergence of cultures like never before. You had 130 leprosy patients, 500 inmates, including Jimmy Hoffa's lawyer, an ancient order of nuns, and a Franciscan monk all thrown together in this colony.
It's quite a crew.
Wow.
Well, were the prisoners and the patients allowed to mix? Were you on separate sides of the building? Or
we lived on separate sides of the building, but there were common hallways, and every time we went to the cafeteria, we passed each other, or if we were going to get medical treatment, and we were their helpers. We helped. I did the menu board in the leprosy cafeteria. There was a rule against fraternization, but what's really interesting about this, a leprosy patient would talk to me, and the guard, the prison guard, would say, "You can't talk to him." And they would say, "You can't tell me what to do." I mean, they weren't in charge of the leprosy patients, the Bureau of Prisons. So after a while, they sort of dropped that, and we talked all the time, and especially when guards weren't around.
Well, Neil, you mentioned also nuns and monks. Now,
yeah.
Why were the nuns and monks there?
Well, the nuns were there because they were the original caretakers. It was the Daughters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul. I think they just, everybody calls them the Sisters of Charity. They came in 1898 because no physicians would visit the Louisiana Leper Home, and they made it their mission to care for the bodies and the souls of the victims of leprosy, and they had been there since 1898. And they continued to be there. So they were there to care for the leprosy patients. And the Franciscan monk, Father Reynolds, was sort of their leader and the priest for the Catholic Church and a minister to the leprosy patients.
Wow, what a ministry. My
yeah.
gosh.
Yeah.
Well, one of the very first patients that you came into contact with was Ella Bounds,
right.
An elderly woman, and she was in an antique wheelchair.
She was, yes.
Because she had lost both legs to the disease.
Right.
So she really becomes kind of the soul of your book, and you really developed quite a friendship. Can you tell us about her?
Sure. She was taken to the colony when she was 12 years old. And when I met her, she was almost 80. So I was standing in front of this woman who had been there for 68 years because she was susceptible to a bacterial infection. And I had mishandled millions of dollars and was only there for 18 months. So from the get-go, it was really impossible for me to muster up any self-pity. I mean, the stories of the leprosy patients were so remarkably tragic. I mean, when they arrived, they were not allowed to vote. They were not allowed to marry. They were made to change their names. They were given an inmate number. Their mail was baked before it was released to the general public. If a romance struck up and a woman became pregnant, the child was taken away immediately. And when they died, because most of their families abandoned them, they were buried in a cemetery on the back of the colony, and most of the tombstones are marked with their alias, their fake name. I mean, just unbelievable stories. But this woman and a few of the other patients had also found some real peace there. And she had an innate understanding of what really mattered in life that most of us have trouble hanging on to out in this modern world that we live in. And so she was just such a foil to me. I mean, she was an African-American woman, 80, weak in body but strong in spirit, and I was a 32-year-old healthy white man, model of physical health, but who had just completely lost his way in terms of morals and ethics. And she was incredibly helpful to me, and not so much as a teacher, but just as a friend.
Our guest is Neil White, author of In the Sanctuary of Outcasts, his memoir of downfall and redemption. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on iHeartRadio app or iHeartRadio.com. Now, back to our conversation with Neil White about his stay in the last leper colony in the United States. So, Neil, you were talking about Ella Bounds and how she really inspired you. Was she taken to this leper colony against her will, and did that happen to a lot of the patients that were there?
Yes. You know, for most of the 20th century up to 1959, anybody in the continental United States who contracted leprosy was taken there against their will, sometimes at gunpoint, sometimes in shackles, sometimes by a paid driver they called the bounty hunter. And the bounty hunter in 1920-something went to find Ella and take her away. And he basically went to the house to put up a quarantine sign on their tenant house. And her father stepped in and would not let the bounty hunter take her. But he knew. He was a farmer. And, you know, if you're somebody in your family has leprosy, nobody's going to barter with your crops. He knew what he had to do. And so he took her himself to the colony.
Wow. And then you also learned a great deal about the history and treatment of leprosy from patient Jimmy Harris,
yes,
who had also been at Carville for decades. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. He had a number of people in his family who had leprosy, and this is one of those chilling stories. I remember him telling me one time his sister had had leprosy, and I think his brother may have had leprosy. Six people in his family ultimately had it, and he was out in a barbecue in a dusty West Texas field, and he came into his room when he was 19, and he looked down on his leg, and because his leg was sweating, it was covered with this dirt that had stuck to his leg, except on this one oval round spot where the sweat glands had stopped working. And he knew right then he had leprosy.
Mm. Oh. And how long had he been in Carville when you met him?
Well, I suppose Jimmy was 84, maybe 85. And so he had been in and out of Carville for 60 plus years. But he also, his body was not ravaged by it as much as everybody else. He had this claw hand where his nerves, he wouldn't be able to open his hand fully. But he left Carville for a period and was a photographer, a wedding photographer in Fishery, Louisiana for about 25 or 30 years. He just came back as an older man because he needed treatment.
Well, Neil, after you really got to know all of these people living there, was it surprising to you that most of the patients at Carville, they really formed a community within themselves, almost like they were all family, and that most of them actually really didn't even want to leave?
It was interesting, because you would have thought that they couldn't wait to get out, but what was once their prison had become their sanctuary, their safe haven. Nobody stared if they had a swollen face or a newly amputated limb. They all were empathetic with one another. They had their own really special cultures and mores, Mardi Gras parades, that sort of thing. They had their own magazine that they published. They even referred to themselves as the secret people because they had this world behind these colony walls that nobody ever got to see. And so I didn't know that they were free to go until I'd been there about 3 months. And then when I found out that the gates were wide open for them, but they had chosen to live here, it really drove home the stigma of leprosy in our culture.
Right. And it's almost like, where would they go?
Yeah, exactly. There was another man named Harry that I met who, and this is not in the book, this part is, but he tried to shake my hand. He only had one digit, and I didn't know what to do, and I think he thought that I was rejecting him. But he told me that when he was a young man, he used to go out to the bars when they let the gates open, and he's terribly disfigured by the disease. And he said people kept asking him what was wrong, and he would tell them sometimes he was in a fire or sometimes he was in a terrible auto wreck. And he said, I finally quit going out because I got tired of fibbing.
Wow.
He could not tell them that he had leprosy, or they would have kicked him out of the bar or all run. I mean, it's just the stigma surrounding the disease is worse in some regards than the physical ramifications. Leper is synonymous with outcast and scourge.
Well, Neil, you said that you intended to write a very different story at the beginning of your jail time than right. You did upon your release. How did the story and you ultimately change by your 18 short months at Carville?
Well, when I was there, I was a big George Plimpton fan, you know, the immersion journalism. And about a week into this experimental prison that I'd been thrown into, it occurred to me when I was mopping the floor in a kitchen that even George Plimpton couldn't weasel his way into a prison leprosarium. And I wasn't going to buy into this inmate stuff. I was going to pretend like I was going to be an undercover reporter and write this expose about this horrible government experiment that was, you know, kind of like Tuskegee, where inmates were exposed to leprosy. And by the time the 18 months was over and my sentence was ended, I could never have written that book because that's not how it turned out. Well, the truth is, other than the birth of my children, this was the most significant event in my adult life, and I was so grateful for it that I couldn't write a book like that. And so I waited a long time to try and get it right and write a very different kind of book about what actually happened.
Well, finally, Neil, is Carville still open?
Carville is still open. There are only 6 leprosy patients who still live there. Harry is one of them. We talk every Sunday night. He calls me, and I send him wine with a screw top bottle. He can't really use a corkscrew every once in a while. And we're still friends. But 6 leprosy patients. And then it also is a youth challenge camp where at-risk youth go to sort of reestablish their lives and get some direction. It's also, there's a division of a chemical weapons plant there, and it is the morgue for natural disasters in Louisiana. It was the morgue for Katrina.
Wow. Neil White, author of In the Sanctuary of Outcasts, thanks so much for sharing your amazing story with the Two Boomer Babes.
It's my pleasure.
Did you know that the Old Farmer's Almanac has been around for 220 years and is the oldest running publication in North America? For a little perspective, the first edition was released when George Washington was president.
Although relatively unchanged over the years, the almanac has never gone out of fashion. As usual, it's full of tips about saving money, weather predictions, trends, recipes, and topics as varied as a pioneer's cure for baldness to trivia about spit.
Since we recently celebrated Earth Day, we thought we'd ask Janice Stillman, the editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, about the almanac's eerily accurate weather predictions and what's in store for us weather-wise this summer and fall.
And we sure hope it's blue skies and mild temps after the winter most of us have endured. We'll also talk about some old-time farm beliefs that may sound a tad crazy, but are based on thousands of years of planting experience. Janice joins us on the phone from Dublin, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to know, Janice, if we could break out the shorts anytime soon. So what is the almanac predicting for the country in general this summer and fall?
Well, you know, we're predicting above-normal temperatures around most of the country. Now, that said, I have to admit that we did predict colder than normal temperatures across most of the country. I know a lot of the folks in the West Coast and western portions of the country did not experience that at all. But summer, that's our expectation, above normal temperatures nearly everywhere.
And is there a particular region of the country that's really going to get a lot of extremes?
We predict temperature and precipitation as variations on the norm. I can tell you that the one place right now that looks like it won't be quite as warm as the rest of the country is up in northern Idaho and points on both east and west of that area. So it's a narrow little area if you want to escape a lot of the heat. That's
well,
the
only about
now.
3 people live there, so they're pretty lucky, I guess.
So did you actually predict all of this precipitation that we've had?
Well, we did certainly predict snowy conditions on much of the East Coast, in fact, all the way down into Georgia. So I know any listeners in the Mid-Atlantic will high-five that. So northern Texas, Oklahoma, some of the Midwest, up in Minnesota and surrounding areas, the lakes regions, they had high snow forecasts and indeed high snow. So a lot of the cold temps and snows that we predicted pretty much in the eastern half or two-thirds of the country are pretty accurate. We won't know our accuracy actually until end of summer when we calculate this year and get ready to introduce the next edition with the next year's forecast. But as I say, portions of the West Coast and western half of the United States or so probably were not as cold as we predicted.
Well, Janice, how does the almanac predict weather every year? Is there a secret formula that you have all locked up in some safe somewhere?
Well, there is a black box down the hall in the editor-in-chief's office. I've seen it, and indeed on our website, almanac.com, there's a video of me trying to get it open, which is actually kind of amusing. But in it, there is a secret formula.
Ooh.
But in fact, we don't do the weather forecast here. We have been working with a fellow named Michael Steinberg since 1995, and he makes a forecast for us. We do use the same scientific disciplines that Robert B. Thomas used back in 1792, when he founded the Old Farmer's Almanac. Of course, we have state-of-the-art technology and all the latest weather information, and use the ocean temps and the various oscillations and some of the references to how forecasts are made, or that other weather forecasters make. But essentially, we use solar science, which is a study of the activity on the sun, in particular the sunspots, climatology, which is the study of prevailing conditions over time, and meteorology, which is the study of the atmosphere, such as the jet stream and like that.
Well, Janice, back to the secret formula, which I'm totally intrigued by. Who put the secret formula in that black box to begin with, and when did that even happen?
You know, the Old Farmer's Almanac is 222 years old, and if I had the answer to that question,
you'd have to kill us, right?
It happened sometime over the course of those years. Robert B. Thomas, who's pictured on the cover of the Old Farmer's Almanac on the right, and Benjamin Franklin is on the left, it was Robert B. Thomas who devised the formula originally. He was the editor for 80 years, beginning in 1792. So I don't know if it was he or one of his followers.
With the upcoming warmer season, we hope will really be upon us very quickly. How will hurricanes be this year? What are you all predicting there?
Well, we're expecting an active hurricane season overall, with a major hurricane making landfall on the central Gulf Coast in July, and several hurricanes and tropical storms threatening Florida and the Atlantic seaboard in September.
Wow. So get ready. Are you talking Louisiana? That part of the Gulf Coast?
It's possible. I mean, you know, we're predicting that the hurricane event will occur. Where it'll actually make landfall, it's hard to tell right now.
And do you see that we're going to have the extremes that we had in 2013?
Well, as I mentioned, in terms of temperature, yes, we're predicting above normal temperatures across most of the country for the summer, except that small area in northern Idaho and in the Rockies there. We're looking for wet conditions that is above normal precipitation on much of the East Coast and a portion of Northern California and Southern Oregon. Really, we're expecting dry conditions beyond that across most of the country. And when I say dry, I mean below normal precipitation.
We're talking with Janice Stillman, editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, about the Almanac's very accurate weather predictions and some old-time farm beliefs. So, Janice, speaking of planting folklore, we babes are famous for killing any living plant, so we want to ask you about a few of them. So first, is it true that to make a plant grow, you should spit into the hole you've dug for it?
That dates back centuries as well. You know, early farmers and gardeners didn't have scientific information to rely on, much less the reference books and resources to look back into. So, you know, if something worked one day quite by accident, they may have tried it again, and that may be one of those things. So a lot of folkloric adages that you come to know and you'll see in the Old Farmer's Almanac on a regular basis, actually, because they're great fun, you know, may or may not actually work, but, you know, you just try.
There's no harm in trying, right? Well, and I love this one, and I think this is the problem I have with my plants. Never thank a person for giving you a plant, or it will die. And that certainly happens in my house. Where did that come from, besides, you know, maybe they had a hidden camera in my home?
Well, again, it just dates back from maybe pure coincidence. Oftentimes, these things become part of the local lore. We, you know, sort of an urban legend of the 18th century, perhaps. They just come to be almost expectations. So, you know, a couple that I really like are, it's time to plant corn when your wife comes to bed naked.
Oh, wow. I wonder if you plant it exactly at that time. Like, Or you have to wait.
Or how they look when they're naked.
Or you wait till the morning.
Right.
Well, speaking of morning, you should, as some are advised anyway, plant cucumbers while you're wearing your pajamas on the first day of May before sunrise, and no bugs will eat them.
Yeah. Oh. And, you know, speaking of naked, I love this one. Flax will grow tall if you show it your buttocks. And maybe it depends on the buttocks. I don't know. If I showed them mine, I'm not sure how fast it would grow.
And yes, there you go. And unless you sit on time after sowing it, it will not grow. Because, of course, it's important to be always on time.
Oh, very clever. Very clever.
And I also like the one, the best way to ensure plants will thrive is to steal them.
But then you got to go to jail. Well, I mean, is it worth it?
I know.
That's in the almost the opposite of giving a gift now, isn't it? You know, you give a gift of a plant and it will die, but you pinch a piece of somebody's flowering plant and, boy, it'll thrive in your house. So, you know, all folklore and just great fun.
Well, Janice Stillman, editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, this has been lots of fun.
Well, thanks, and yourself as well. And remember, no matter what the weather is, the only perfect climate is in bed.
Oh, we love that. We'll have to tell our husbands. Okay, well, thank you so much on that note for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
Up next,
our eyes tell a lot about our health. Our eyes can tell a lot about our health. Sudden and brief vision changes, for example, may be a sign of an oncoming dangerous health issue, such as an impending stroke. Yikes!
Joining us to discuss health issues that involve or start with a visual symptom is Dr. Mark Moster, a neuro-ophthalmologist and neurologist at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, an internationally renowned eye center. Welcome, Dr. Moster.
Thank you.
So why is it that our eyes can be so, shall we say, insightful about our health?
Well, in terms of the issue of stroke, the brain is supplied by the same artery that supplies the eyes. So very often there'll be a symptom in the eyes that's a sign of brain disease. And in fact, 40% of the nerve fibers in the brain deal in some way with the eyes. So it's no surprise that a lot of neurologic conditions can begin with or manifest with eye symptoms.
So what kinds of other dangerous health issues, you know, really involve or start with a visual symptom besides, say, a stroke?
Well, you could have brain tumors that begin with eye problems, very commonly a pituitary adenoma. You can have, in younger people, multiple sclerosis very often begins in the eyes with visual loss or double vision. So many, many other conditions can begin with eye symptoms.
So how do you know when a vision problem or problems are serious enough to really warrant going to the emergency room?
Well, I think the main issue is whether you've got a sudden change that's very unusual for you. If you've got a visual loss, say, in one eye or both eyes that you've never experienced before, that you don't have a track record, so it hasn't been evaluated by a medical physician, and it's something that you're not used to, that is a sign of something serious and should warrant an emergency evaluation.
And also, of course, like any type of pain in the eye?
If it's a brand new situation and you're not used to having pain, then it should be evaluated. If it's merely pain that's not terribly severe without any other symptoms, then you can go for a routine evaluation with an ophthalmologist. But if it's severe pain or associated with other symptoms, then it's more of an emergency. On the other hand, if you've had a history of pain in the eye before, let's say it's one of the manifestations of migraine headaches that you get frequently, then it's not as much of an emergency. So a lot of it has to do with what you've had before and whether something's an acute change for you.
So I guess it's really, you know, knowing kind of what is normal for you and for your eyes, and not that every little blurry vision episode is something that's could be a dire diagnosis.
I think that's fair to say. We don't want everyone running to the emergency room with every minor symptom, but if there's a big change for you that you don't expect, then you shouldn't ignore that, and then you should be evaluated.
Well, let me ask you kind of about the physiology of this, which I think is really interesting. So when I think of stroke symptoms, you know, I think of slurred speech and, you know, face drooping and weakness on one side, you know, et cetera. So how does the eye indicate an impending stroke?
So
what are you looking for?
The most common thing that we would see would be a visual loss in one eye. And the carotid artery, which supplies the brain, on the way up, supplies the eye through the ophthalmic artery. And so if you have a lack of blood flow there, you get blurred vision. And sometimes it's like a curtain that comes down from above or goes up from below, and often will last only minutes, and that would be a warning sign of a stroke from a little clot that moved through the circulation to the eye, and could be a warning sign that within a day or so you might have another clot going into the brain, giving you the slurred speech or the loss of sensation or strength.
Wow.
The other thing that can happen is that in the brain itself we have areas that deal with vision. So just like you can get weakness on one side with a stroke, you can get visual blurring on one side of space. So say the entire right side of space may be blurry. And it's the same kind of physiology of lack of blood flow to the areas controlling this function that there would be with, say, slurred speech or language or weakness.
Well, Doctor, let me ask you, if you go just for a routine checkup to the eye doctor, is there any way that they can tell, even if you're not experiencing symptoms, that, you know, you might be having some more serious problems by looking at your eyes?
Yeah, so there are numerous things that can be found. First of all, if you've ever had a clot go through the carotid circulation, you might see little clots in the retina sitting in the arterioles that were asymptomatic. And so that's a sign that in the past there's been lack of blood flow in that area. Additionally, by looking in the eyes, one can often see changes due to diabetes or high blood pressure that may be asymptomatic but can be seen on a fundoscopic exam, the back of the eye in the retina.
And Doctor, how, just as a question, I guess, for myself, how often should you get an eye checkup?
Well, it depends on what kind of history you have as well. I think as a young adult, it could be every few years. If you're an older person, then and you've got any kind of risk factors like elevated cholesterol or diabetes or high blood pressure, it likely should be once a year. If you're diagnosed with a condition such as glaucoma or macular degeneration, then you should be evaluated more frequently than that.
Okay, Doctor, can you also tell us about, we read about there's a study that you're addressing for vision symptoms related to stroke risk. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on?
So one of my colleagues here, Dr. Murchison, is involved in that study in the emergency room at Wills. And what they're trying to study along with the stroke specialists at Jefferson, which is our affiliated university here, is what's the appropriate treatment for patients with visual symptoms related to stroke. Traditionally, in the ophthalmology world, if someone had blurred vision that was transient, it would not be considered a dire emergency. But it seems that there's a movement along in the stroke world and recommendations even by the American Heart Association that we consider a transient visual loss in the eye similar to a TIA in the brain or transient ischemic attack in the brain, which is really an emergency, and moving towards having those people be evaluated emergently, either in an emergency room or a stroke center, somewhere where there's real expertise in the acute evaluation and treatment of stroke symptoms. So the study will be looking at trying to figure out what's the best kind of care for the future.
So, Doctor, then what's the message you would like to leave?
So I would say that if anyone has an abrupt change in their vision, either in one eye or the other, whether it lasts for just a few minutes or even persists longer than that, that they should be evaluated emergently. If they happen to live in a city where there is a 24/7 ophthalmologic emergency room, which many cities have but some don't, then if it's a visual symptom, I think that's probably the place to go. In many places where that's not available, I'd say the emergency room is the place to go. And that would be my message.
Well, Dr. Mark Moster of the Wills Eye Hospital, thanks so much for bringing to light the importance of really paying attention to these sudden vision changes.
Welcome.
For additional information, visit www.willseye.org.
A generation ago, many Americans just assumed that when they grew older and more frail, they would go to a nursing home or an assisted living facility. But aging looks really different today. Think Zumba classes and online dating, and lots of seniors are looking to remain independent and stay in their homes as long as possible.
Natalie Galucha is the Member Services Coordinator of Village to Village Network, which is the national umbrella organization of community senior villages springing up all over the country. The goal is to help seniors stay independent by offering a variety of services. She joins us on the phone from St. Louis to tell us how it all works. Welcome to the program, Natalie.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here today. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about these village networks. How do they work?
Villages are actually each their own nonprofit organizations. They are grassroots, membership-driven. So they are often started by older adults in the community for older adults themselves and then continue to be run by older adults as well. They are typically an organization that has, you know, possibly one or two paid staff, and then the rest is, you know, the day-to-day tasks are carried out by volunteers. So typically they offer services that, again, are provided by those volunteers, such as transportation, so maybe a ride to the doctor or even to go grocery shopping, someone to come over and help with, like, house cleaning or yard work, companionship, legal assistance, different things like that. Any of those little things that could possibly be a barrier for someone to be able to remain living in their own home. And then oftentimes there's the social aspects of it too, where they have lots of programming, so trips to museums, luncheons, book clubs, knitting clubs, all of the different things that individuals might want and need to, again, be able to stay socially engaged and living in their community.
Well, Natalie, give us an idea of the type of person that would really benefit from joining a village network.
Sure. These are typically older individuals. I mean, some villages have an age limit of 65 and older. Some there's no age limit. Some it's 50 and over, so it depends. Who are rather independent, you know, are able to mostly take care of themselves, but then, like I said, there's maybe those one or two things or more that they might need help with, you know, on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, and that's what the village can provide for them. Or, you know, possibly maybe they their children have moved away, their friends have moved away, different things like that, and so this village really provides them the opportunity to be engaged, you know, have new friends, you know, and really give back to their community that they've, you know, possibly spent most of their life in.
Well, Natalie, with these villages, so I'm assuming they really are physically, they're in an area that's together or that's nearby?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. So it's not a building. It's a virtual village, if you will. So it's oftentimes, you know, a certain part of the city, depending on how big the city is, where the village is, that would be considered its footprint. So the service area and the area of members that are able to, or people that are able to join and be members. So for instance, you know, in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, in D.C. alone, I think there are about 13 different villages. You know, so there's Glover Park, there's Foggy Bottom, there's Capitol Hill, and then even out into Maryland and down into Virginia, there are a number of different villages. And oftentimes, you know, they're kind of neighborhood-based because, you know, each part of town can be a little bit different than the others. You know, maybe there's different services, there's different needs, different cultures, you know, whatever it might be. So really that they can tailor the village to those specific needs, you know, and make it very specific for the group of people that are living there.
Well, Natalie, let's talk more specifically about the services that you mentioned. And I'm just wondering, you know, what about seniors who have some medical issues? They're still independent, but they have some issues, and they certainly want to remain in their homes as long as possible. Can villages take an active role in, like, coordination of medical care or, you know, even providing caregiving once in a while?
Sure. So it varies village by village, so each village is going to look different. But a lot of villages do know that, you know, this is sometimes something that's needed and do try and offer it. So maybe they do have someone on staff who is able to act as more of a care coordinator, or, you know, possibly have even trained some volunteers to, like you said, provide some of those light caregiving tasks that would be needed. But then the other component of a village that I actually haven't mentioned yet is a lot of them have what's called a vetted provider list. So it's kind of like an Angie's List just for the village, where the village is going to go out and find organizations in the community that they can then refer to their members. And they look at the licensing, get references of all of that, and then they put them on a list and then give that list to the member, and then they can choose, so maybe they would choose a home health agency or something like that, knowing that the village has looked into them, has said that, yes, from what they've looked at, it looks like this is a good company to use, and can kind of have that reassurance of knowing, possibly other village members have used them, or just knowing that the village has, done what they can to make sure that this is a good organization to go with.
Well, another concern also with boomers and our aging parents and relatives are, and especially if we don't live nearby, is when our loved one has, say, a doctor's appointment, it's mm-hmm. so nice to have that other person there with a second set of ears, et cetera. Is that something that could be, through this vetted provider list, available?
Yes, I think that would definitely be available through there. And actually, we're seeing it popping up in more and more villages where they offer that through their volunteers. So it would be a volunteer who would offer to go along and provide that second set of ears, take notes, all of that, and even sit down with them again afterwards, go over that, and can kind of, be that person. And oftentimes, it works out to where the same volunteer is matched up with the same volunteer for, multiple appointments. So that it's always the same person going with them, and they have that reassurance of, this person knows what's going on and can kind of help me out and possibly answer some of the questions or remind me of some of the questions that I wanted to ask, those different types of things as well.
We're talking with Natalie Galucha, Member Services Coordinator of Village to Village Network, about community senior villages that are springing up all over the country. Well, Natalie, of course, another major issue for those who are getting on in years is transportation. And, we know that, when you can no longer drive and maybe you live in a suburb or you live in a rural area, you might mm-hmm. have to move from your house just because you can't get anywhere. So what kind of services can a village provide for that?
Sure. Most villages do offer volunteer transportation drivers. So these are often, individual volunteers who live in the community, who drive their own cars and will come over and pick you up, drop you off where you need, possibly even stay with you, say if it was at a doctor's appointment or grocery shopping, something like that, and then bring you back home. Or even if it works out better, so where one person picks you up and one person drops you off. Most villages are very flexible and try to get their members where they need to go and when they need to go. Because a lot of times, even if there's public transportation available in the community, maybe it stops running past 7 o'clock at night. That doesn't mean that someone doesn't want to be out until 9 or 10 o'clock at night. So that's what's really great about having a village volunteer that might be able to come over and help transport you. And then, of course, there is the vetted provider list too. So if it is something, such as daily rides to appointments where possibly they don't really have the capacity or enough volunteers to do that, often they will work with, some other type of medical transport company or something like that to make sure that that service is, again, delivered. And then oftentimes with the vetted provider list, I actually forgot to mention this, the providers offer discounts for the village members, so they might be able to get that right then for a reduced rate if it's not, again, something that's able to be provided by a volunteer.
Well, is there a membership fee for joining a village?
Typically, there is. Most villages do have a membership fee, and right now the average is about $400 a year for an individual and $650 a year for a household, which would include having two or more people living in the same house under a membership. Hmm.
And so what does that fee exactly include? All of these coordination of services?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it does. It really gives you, it's kind of a one-stop shop, if you will, where you can pick up the phone, call the village, say you need a ride to the doctor or you need someone to come over and help you clean out your closet, those different things. And then the village takes it from there. They figure out the best volunteer match for that. They help coordinate the best time that's going to work out and all of that. Or, if it needs to be referred to the service provider list, they help you navigate that. So that full coordination of whatever services you need, but then also, as I mentioned, the social component. So, you know, you're either able to go to events for free being a member, or, you know, at a discounted rate. So, you know, they might negotiate rates at the theater or something like that. You know, it kind of provides that insurance and peace of mind, knowing that you have your village there for you, that they're going to be able to help you, you know, if whenever something comes up. So that's what you get for that low fee a year.
Well, Natalie, you know, clearly you rely on a lot of volunteers for providing some services. So what kind of volunteers are you looking for? This could be a great opportunity for, you know, people in the community.
Yeah, it really, really is. And I really think that villages are looking for anybody and everybody that is interested in this. Because, like I said, the list of services often that is provided by volunteers is pretty long, you know, and a wide range of things. You know, even things like technology, helping get computers or iPhones set up or Twitter accounts or Facebook accounts, you know, things like that. You know, other handyman type work, coming over and helping change light bulbs. Or, you know, maybe hanging the picture, you know, different things like that. So it's really a wide range of skills.
And then I'm wondering if it's also possible to be a member of a village, but also a volunteer, so you kind of feel like you're giving back?
Yes, absolutely. That is, I would say for a lot of villages, that a good percent of their members are members and then also volunteers back as well. And then a lot of villages also reach out even to the younger community members as well. So maybe some middle schoolers and high schoolers to, again, be able to help with some of the things like technology, yard work, different things like that. So it's really inclusive of everybody in all ages as well.
Sounds like a great opportunity for all those service learning required hours for graduation.
Absolutely. It's a great opportunity for that.
Natalie Galucha, Member Services Coordinator of Village to Village Network, thank you so much for sharing this important information with the two Boomer Babes.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Traveling by train can be nostalgic, oh so civilized, and very romantic. One thing it's not is boring, with unnervingly steep grades, windy mountain passes, and jaw-dropping scenery that's difficult to experience any other way.
So just what are our options for a train travel adventure? Travel guru Deb Stone is back with the babes to shoot the breeze about the most scenic and spectacular rail trips in North America. She joins us on the phone from Santa Fe. Welcome, Deb.
Oh, thanks for having me. Let's talk trains.
Hey, yes. Yay. Well, why would somebody want to travel by train? What's the appeal?
Train trips really allow people the opportunity to experience parts of the country in a very unique way. And it gives a really new perspective on our country. You can sit back, be mesmerized by the views, all the while by relaxing with lots of leg room, getting up and moving around, eating and drinking when you want to. It's definitely a comfortable experience while you sit back and just enjoy.
Well, Deb, what's the best way to travel by train? I mean, do we just call Amtrak, or should we look for a tour or an escorted tour?
Yes, you can go look at Amtrak.com. There are many, many. They have over 500, I think, destinations that Amtrak goes to. And you know, think to yourself, do you want a half day, a day, or multi-day, a week long? What do you want in terms of the time-wise that you would be away on a train trip?
Okay, so say we want to see some spectacular scenery, of which there's so much in the United States. What would you recommend?
I think the most famous trips for scenery are out west because the scenery is so dramatic. You know, if you're looking for something just during the day to do for a day trip, it would be the Grand Canyon Railway, which would be wonderful. Another would be the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad in Colorado. And, of course, there's the fabulous Rocky Mountaineer, which goes from Vancouver to Calgary in Canada.
And how much would that cost?
The Vancouver to Calgary, which is the Rocky Mountaineer, which is not Amtrak, is basically 2 days, one night, and it starts at about $1,000.
Wow. I hope that includes food.
Yes, it does, and it includes a hotel along the way.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Deb, what are the accommodations like for overnights on a train, you know, or extended travel?
Okay, well, if you're at Amtrak, you can book a roomette, for example, which is two beds, no toilet or shower. You could book a bedroom for two beds, one toilet and one shower, or a bedroom suite with four beds, two toilets, and two showers.
Well, how much does all this cost?
depending on the length of time that you're gone, the type, the route, et cetera, et cetera. For example, Seattle to Los Angeles, up and down the West Coast on the Amtrak Coast Starlight would be about $450 per person one way with a roomette.
Hmm. And then, of course, you can always sit up all night like I've done, which I would not recommend.
That sounds extremely comfortable, Barb.
Oh, it's horrible. I've done that, too.
Exactly. Our doctor bills were more than the cost of the train. But that's another story.
But, you know, take it in consideration about the cost. If you're in a roomette and it's that much money, you also get all your meals.
Oh, so the $450 includes meals.
Yes, of course.
I hope so. Well, Deb, say our inheritance, or we've just won the lottery, and we want to go all out and really ride in style and comfort. What's the best luxury train trip out there?
If the sky's the limit, I think I would do the Venice Simplon Orient Express, the six-day Paris to Istanbul in restored 1920s-era cars, but it starts at $9,000 per person.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a chunk of change.
Well, how about Amtrak? Do they actually offer rail passes like they do in Europe, those good old days when we were backpacking through Europe?
Yes, they do. The USA Rail Pass, you can get it in different day denominations. So for 15 days, for example, $439, 30 days, $669, and 45 days, $859.
Well, that's pretty cool. Now, that's sitting up, I imagine.
That is not a roomette or any type of room.
Oh, those are those very sleepy-looking, dirty people that need a shower that's cruising the Amtrak.
Smelly as well.
Right. Well, Deb, is Amtrak the best rail line in the United States? And if not, which one is?
Amtrak's wonderful because you can visit over 500 destinations in the country. However, if you want other railways that are privately owned, you would do perhaps American Train Trips, and you could look up their website. Or AmericanTrainVacations.com. You can look at their website, and they have an extensive private journeys throughout the United States.
Well, travel guru Deb Stone, our bags are packed. Thanks so much for sharing your fabulous travel tips once again with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks so much for having me.
See you on the rails. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications. Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.